being selected by Jenny Finch and her team for the Book of the Month is quite frankly one of the pinnacles of any writer's ambition. Don't ask me how I know this.
Hello. This month's Book of the Month is Spirit Sight by Marie-Pole Powell. Spirit Sight is a medieval fantasy novel set in Wales that tells the story of the English King Edward I's final and successful invasion of Wales in the late 13th century. It is seen mainly through the eyes of Hugh and his sister Catelyn, siblings who have inherited the power of sight through their mother. Hugh can control the minds of animals, and Catelyn is a seer, and both of them must develop their good gifts to help fight the English. Hugh is present when his prince, Llewellyn, is killed, and the spirit of the dead man enters his mind. As the Welsh are driven from their castles and land by the invaders, Hugh and Catelyn play vital roles in the Welsh defence. Throughout their story, Llewellyn and Hugh become more closely bonded, but this brings the risk of Hugh being accused of sorcery by many at the court.
Rain and the noises of the forest slowed Hugh's progress. He dared not use his gift to find out more this time, after Gawain's warning. Twice he followed sounds he thought were Welsh voices, hoping to find some sign of his Dar. None of the sounds led to camps or soldiers. The hair crept up on his neck as he peered at the dark thickets, but he persevered along the path at the prince's urging. This way, follow this stream, and it will lead you to Rhuddlan. When Hugh closed his eyes, he could see Llewellyn dressed in his fur travelling cloak. Without thinking, drew Gawain's quilted one tighter around himself. We must make haste. Once his stores ran out, Hugh picked frozen roots and berries he knew to be edible, wrapping them in the cloth held next to his body to warm them. The stream was frozen, but he melted snow in a skin pouch the same way. A steady drizzle of cold, wet snow melted around him as it fell, filling his shoes with slush. Before long, he was wrapped in mud and grime from the road. More than once, he consoled himself by remembering he would soon be closer to Garth Kellyn. He might at last reunite with his mother and sister. At dawn, on the fourth day of his journey, Hugh saw the spires of Rhuddlan. Sounds of clanking metal travelled across the still valley. Swords rang across armour, reminding him the English occupied the castle. He circled around to the gatehouse. As he tried to dash through the back entryway, someone grabbed him by the strap of the neck and pulled him backwards. "What do you think, Thomas? Worth a shilling?" Hugh heard a short bark of laughter behind him. "Nay, brother," said another voice, "probably some village brat. You know the king won't pay for women and children." "Just need to dip their heads in their own gore," came a third. "I hear they ain't looking too closely. These Welsh women with their short cropped hair look like men anyways. Good for a tup and a shilling, eh? Boys the same."
"Oh, please, sir," Hugh mimicked the accent of the boys he'd fostered with as best he could and held up the roots from his cloth sack. "Cook sent me for summat to spice the stew. These Welsh devils never use anything, and the king is plenty sick of bland."
"Ach, let him go. He'll be in the kitchens when we need him." The hand that held him let go abruptly. Hugh lost his balance but managed to scramble upright. One of the soldiers landed a kick on his behind that shoved him through the entranceway, and he ran without looking back. He'd been worried what Llewellyn might think of his outburst, but he was reassured by the prince's laughter in his inner ear. "Quick thinking, boy! Now follow through, and we might get out of this with our skins."
Spirit Sight is the first part of a series entitled The Last of the Gifted, with the second book, Water Sight, concluding this story. It blends mythology, fantasy, and a wealth of historical detail from the period 1282 to 83 to create an exciting narrative. Aimed at the young adult reader, it is also a good read for adults and should appeal to history fans, as well as those who enjoy more imaginative stories. Powell has done a great deal of research and presents a rich and detailed picture of life in medieval Wales. She presents the beleaguered Welsh court with sympathy and introduces the reader to both military and artistic elements of life at the time.
Hugh crouched and crept forward through the hidden door in the wall. Mist shrouded the courtyard of Dolwiddlan Castle. The banner streaming out above them was Llewellyn's, with three red lions for the Prince of Wales. It was mid-afternoon, yet all seemed as quiet and still as night. He hesitated as he spotted a guard in the yard. Hugh could see the badge on the guard's cloak, showing a blue lion striding forward on a gold field. He frowned. "The lions of Gwynedd, blue for my brother and heir. This is David's man. He has not yet changed his colours." The mist seemed to magnify the slight disorientation Hugh felt when the prince spoke inside his mind. If he closed his eyes, he would see the prince clearly. Yet he could not help but stare at the guard, who stayed silent and immobile in the swirling mist. Hugh felt the hairs raise on the back of his neck. "It's just like the stories say," marveled Llewellyn. "This is truly a gift from the old ones, Hugh. Now we must trust them. Push onward. My brother waits inside the castle, and we must get to him while we can." Hugh made his way carefully behind the guard, who never moved from his position. Two other soldiers also stood still. One held his hand in front of his face as if he was about to pick his nose. Hugh almost wanted to laugh, but he was afraid a noise might break the spell. He slipped up the stone stairs to the castle door. The mist followed, swirling around him. His vision narrowed, and it seemed as if he saw everything through a small round window in the mist. He could not see the castle's great hall clearly unless he turned directly toward it. Then he was inside. The huge fireplace loomed up, leading to the inset window seats. He made his way by the people in the hall, who did not move but seemed frozen in mid-conversation. "More than passing strange," Llewellyn's whisper sounded as if in Hugh's ear. But Hugh was so taken by the sight of the frozen people that he listened without closing his eyes. "Perhaps they are out of time, or we are, as in the old stories. This could be a valuable advantage for us, Hugh, if you could but control it." "It's not my doing," Hugh whispered back, "and I know not why the old ones have favoured us with this time out of time, but I believe it is as my uncle said. We cannot expect to use this to our personal advantage. It would show disrespect." Llewellyn remained silent. Across from the door, Hugh spotted a stairwell and moved toward it. Mist drifted with him as he felt his way along the stone wall to the upper reaches of the castle. To his left, he saw another stairwell that must lead to the wall walk, and he knew without Llewellyn's whispered warning that Dafydd's warriors would be patrolling. He prayed the mist held them trapped as well. To his right was a wooden door. It opened as he neared it, and he stepped inside. A man stood near the fireplace, his back to the door. Hugh watched him rub his hands together for warmth. He didn't understand why this man could move when the others could not.
Powell became interested in Welsh history when exploring her family tree and turning up a Welsh connection. Based in her native Canada, she is the author of over 40 books for children, from picture books to young adult fiction. She also provides help, advice and editing services to other writers and runs a number of very successful workshops. She has won awards for her poetry and short stories and also teaches English and linguistics. Spirit Sight gives a strong account of the brutality of war in the 13th century, especially the actions of the invading English army. There are far fewer details of life in the English camp and very few sympathetic characters on that side of the war. At that time, it was customary for well-connected Welsh boys to join the households of English lords, and there is an important friendship between Hugh and James, the son of Lord Shrewsbury. Whilst there, several friends also befriend him, but overall, the army are shown to be brutal and hostile to all the Welsh they encounter. Whilst this is understandable in some ways, especially as the book is viewed from a Welsh perspective, it does seem to distort history somewhat. The novel is well written and well paced, making the reader eager to know how it will end. It does have a large number of Welsh names and words for people, places, and events. There is a character list at the beginning and an historical note with glossary at the end. The glossary especially would have been very useful at the start, as the Welsh language is hard to read and pronounce for a non-speaker. This tends to make reading difficult in places, as did the use of many Welsh place names. A map or list of the current names of castles, areas, and regions would have made the castle hopping easier to follow, and the threat to the remaining nation much more real. However, this is still a compelling novel and worth the extra effort. Whilst the characters seem to disappear into the hills at the end of the book, their journey does continue in the next novel, and I am sure many readers will be eager to find out their fate.
So there we are, the thoughts of Jenny Finch on Spirit Sight by one of our regular sort of authors and participants, of course, from Canada, Saskatchewan, and Marie Powell. And I have to agree about the glossary. I did think that would be useful at the start as opposed to at the end, but so it goes. We can obviously sort out our Daffids and our Gwyneths and our other Llewellyns as and when. Jessica Burtis in North Carolina. I think you've met up with Marie Powell as well. Any thoughts on this particular part of the duology, of course, this one focusing on Hugh, or actually Hugh and Cat. And of course, before we move into the second adventure that Jenny's alluded to.
Yeah, I think that this series is one that, I mean, talking to Marie Powell is always so fun. I loved her series on cooking and medieval cooking and everything with that. I kept looking for hints of discussions about medieval food in this. But I think that her series is one that interests me because I love historical series and I love fantasy. And I love when that's kind of combined together. I think that also just the idea of getting to know more about the kind of 13th century Welsh culture and world happening in this fictional kind of setting is interesting, because a lot of medieval history that I learned in school was based around England, France, and Germany. So you don't really talk about Wales very often. And getting to see a book set in Wales was really cool, and in seeing Welsh used. It definitely is difficult to read you know, the place names, and it takes some getting used to, especially if you don't really have a knack for it. Like, I don't really have it, so I don't tend to pick it up. The ebook did have a glossary at the beginning of the pronunciation, so I kind of was trying to, but it is trying to go through and remember it. It's a little tough when I'm so used to reading English, and then it's a little tough switching. But I think it's really nice seeing it and seeing that she's put such an effort into including Welsh language in her book, and been so careful to try to respect and represent Welsh culture and language. And I think that that's honestly what part of what makes this book such a standout, in my opinion. But also, her writing is so lovely. I really thought it was very poetic, very descriptive. It's definitely a kind of writing that sounds very musical in your head when you're reading it, which I feel like suits Welsh very well, because Welsh just seems like a very musical language itself. So getting to see her prose written that way, I think, really helped it mesh. And I think also anytime there is a series where a character gets to jump into an animal's mind, I think that's always so cool. So I was kind of already impartial to it from, of course, the very first few sentences.
Yeah, it's interesting insofar as I felt, having completed it in its entirety now, that it actually had a little less fantasy than I'd originally been anticipating. I thought that she would have made more of the fantasy elements. And as I likened it, the kind of sword in the stone moments, again, based on the Arthurian line, in which we had that classic moment where young Arthur effectively inhabits creatures that fly above in the sky and obviously go below underwater, etc. And I felt that actually it worked quite nicely. There was also, I think, in deference to a possible TV series, of course, a classic A and B story. You had the story of Hugh, you had the story of Cat, you had the brother and sister connection there, whilst Hugh was obviously out and about dealing with his challenges. and trying to get back to some sort of sanity, etc. Cat likewise was also dealing with her challenges. And I thought that was very well described. And I think you're absolutely right, Jenny. I think the lyricism that we got here for a young adult book in particular was very effective and very evocative of what I would understand the Welsh language to actually be. But yes, as per the readings, I deliberately selected ones which didn't have too many Llewellyns in terms of the whole system, or Gwynedd and so on. And thank the Lord she didn't actually mention that extraordinarily long Welsh town anywhere in the whole process. Jenny, did you kind of agree with Jessica in terms of the lyricism and in terms of the use of language?
I think so, yes. It was really written to a very high standard for a young adult book, and it had decent length sentences. Sometimes you think people call it a young adult book because they've got sentences of 6 to 10 words. That's it. And yeah, it had a good vocabulary. It would certainly be challenging for some young people, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. So long as you didn't take the whole historical perspective 100% for true, I think, yeah, it's a very laudable and a very nicely written book.
Yes, that blurring of the lines between historical fact and fiction, of course, is quite fascinating. And I think, again, Jessica, the evidence of research was very much the fore. Extensive evidence given at the back of the text as well. We can tell this is a scholarly work as well, but it does obviously play not necessarily fast and loose, but it addresses the whole aspect with respect to the way in which we see the magic and the folk tales and the scenarios actually operating. I mean, clearly the notion of the way in which the prince is inhabiting the mind of Hugh, I thought that was very well handled, because clearly you could also turn around and say Hugh was simply deranged because he'd seen a head de his king decapitated, and then effectively had to cope with post-traumatic stress disorder, which would be a reading that you could actually sort of allude to in the sort of sequence. Favorite moments, Jessica?
Getting to be inside the animal's head is just a really interesting. I think the way that she portrays it in particular is really interesting because she was always keeping that connection between him and the animal at the same time. And I feel like you get to see in a lot of books, there's a lot of fantasy that's centered around communicating with animals. And I think also I'm another historical alternate history fantasy where someone goes into the mind of an animal that I've also read dealing with medieval Northern European history. I don't know what this makes two, which isn't much, but it's two. So it was different because they kind of transformed into the animal. So she has a very unique way of doing that. And I think that that's a really cool just a different idea. And it makes me curious to talk to Marie again now after this kind of retrospective. But also the relationship between Hugh, who, and Kat is also really nicely done. I think sometimes in some series, the sibling relationship can feel overdramatic or it can feel very hollow, and sometimes it just doesn't really feel very realistic. But in this case, they seemed like very caring siblings that had a very realistic relationship, especially for two magical people, you know? So I think that getting to see the relationship between them, it was such a central part of the story. And I think that the choice for her to make siblings that have magical powers kind of the center of it, rather than, I feel like quite a lot of young adult books focus on a romantic pairing instead. And I like that she had siblings and that it was more familial. And I thought that that was nice to kind of center, even though there were romances in the plot. It was just different. And I think it was refreshing.
I personally quite like Lord Shrewsbury. I thought he basically sort of was probably more sort of sympathetic of the English characters, who, as Jenny rightly said, the English not portrayed with any great fondness. Having said that, you could say that at least one of them didn't want to actually decapitate Hugh on the basis of getting a shilling or so for him. Again, in the reading we actually took when he was captured, I thought that's it, he's done for effectively. We do, of course, have to acknowledge the fact historically that sadly England was guilty, or at least Edward Longshanks guilty of a form of attempted genocide, which obviously he didn't succeed in, again probably paved the way for many subsequent attempted genocides, which tend to litter the unfortunate aspects of human history. Any favorite moments from yourself, Jenny? Are you also an animal inhabitor person?
I loved the bit where he went into the mind of the hawk and flew as a hawk. That's like everybody's favorite dream, I think. I also particularly liked, yes, it's related to Lord Shrewsbury, the friendship he had with James, and how James helped him, and how they still remained friends in spite of the fact that they were on completely different sides of a war that could have led to the destruction of one or the other. And I thought that was very well done and had a nice little moral ring to it for young people.
Yeah. And Jessica, favorite characters from yourself?
I think Cat, even though I love the whole animal power, I think Cat, I was immediately just drawn to her character because she's so sensitive and I think caring, but still very strong and independent. And I think that that's a nice balance to have. And I think that her character, with the whole like caring with her mom and with her brother and with the whole idea of the future, and honestly, it would be a pretty scary power compared to being able to be in a hawk's mind, having to deal with the future and the pressure of that. And I think that her character was just very interesting. And I think that in the next book, I would definitely want to keep reading to see more of what happens because the ending does leave room for a continuation. I know it's a duology, so.
Yeah, I think the notion of not just the future, but also the ability to change the future, the fact that actually being able to see the future and then perhaps change it, which of course we see in terms of their escape from one of the castles that's actually there, which again, I have to say, yeah, it would have been quite nice, Jenny, to have actually seen some kind of map to maybe put some physicality in terms of where the castles actually were based.
Yeah, I actually recognize one of the castles. It's still spelt like that. And when we used to go to Wales, my mother took us to every single Welsh castle between Essex and Wales. And so Carrig Kennan is a castle I've been to and I've climbed up, and it's hard work, I have to tell you. The English would have had to have fought very, very hard to take Carrig Kennan.
Maybe it's because they were under financial incentives that they actually were committed to actually do that side of things. That just goes to show the notion of his notion of medieval incentivization. Jessica, your score out of 10 for this particular book of the month?
I'm gonna give this one a 9. I think that it's a very solid young adult book. I think that this is a really great entrance for someone wanting to read historical fiction that's set in a more and just not often utilized setting, and something that really delves into not just using it as a setting, but truly enmeshing it within the story itself. It's you cannot separate the story from Wales. You cannot separate it from Welsh culture. And I think that that makes it very unique and well worth a read just for that alone.
Yeah, I was thinking 8, but I might go 8.5 actually, because I think for all the reasons you've actually mentioned, it does actually bode well from that perspective. Could have gone higher, but it doesn't have a map. But basically, I mean, I'm just looking for too literal a scenario. Jenny?
I'm going to go 8. It's all the good things that Jessica said, but it's slightly unbalanced. It's almost a Welsh propaganda piece, and that's a shame. I can see what she's doing and why she's doing it, but if you're a young person encountering medieval history for the first time, it's going to have a very big impact on you, and not necessarily for the right reasons. Yes, the English were vile. Edward Longshanks was horrible and should have his legs chopped off, but nevertheless, Lord Shrewsbury.
And next month, I believe we're going down the line of Sue Townsend.
Yes, indeed. I would like to suggest next month's Book of the Month is Sue Townsend's The Queen and I.
One is scenario without siren radio. Turn up everyone, save a siren sound. Siren radio. From Lincoln to Miami, Paris to LA, our global community wants to hear it play. Create eight students participate. Keep on keeping on. Keep on keeping on.
Sorry,
keep on keeping on.
Sorry,
keep on keeping on.
Sorry, keep on keeping on.
Keep on keeping on. Say Siren Radio.